Trinity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
This time we really
needed it. Yeah. Oh, my. When I was talking earlier about that third step, our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism, one of the issues that comes up in some areas is, what do you do with people who have more than one addiction? Maybe that hasn't hit Nevada yet. And in some fellowships, this gets real ugly. People get real crazy over it. And my solution is this. If alcoholism is one of the problems, they are most welcome to be there. And if they're not alcoholics, they can't join us. I mean, you got to be an alcoholic to join AA.
Well, what kind of sense does that make?
Let me see if I can find this wonderful section in here. This is from the big book. And it's on page 175, for those of you who need pages. And it is from the story of Dr. Bob Smith. You heard of him? He says, during the next 2 years, I developed two distinct phobias. One was the fear of not sleeping. Anyone relate to that? Terrifying. And the other was the fear of running out of liquor. Not being a man of means, I knew that if I did not stay sober enough to earn money, I would run out of liquor. Most of the time, therefore, I did not take the morning drink, which I craved so badly, but instead would fill up on large doses of sedatives to quiet the jitters. Dr. Bob was a junkie. Which, he goes on to say, the jitters which distressed me seriously. Occasionally I would yield to the morning craving, but if I did, it would only be a few hours before I would be quite unfit for work. This would lessen my chances of smuggling some home that evening, which in turn would mean a night of futile tossing around in bed, followed by a morning of unbearable jitters. During the subsequent 15 years, I had sense enough never to go to the hospital if I'd been drinking. You know, but he just snacked away on those pills. There are some people in my part of the world who would not let him join the fellowship. And I think it's important to read the book for circumstances like that. Okay. That's my opinion, but I'm right. What else? One thing that I just thought was funny, I want to use as a throwaway line because I think it is something I would like to repeat. There was a celebrity in Los Angeles used to talk about the three stages of his drinking. And this happened usually in the course of an evening. He'd go from stage one to stage two to stage three. And he said, in stage one, I was witty. Stage two, I was invisible. And stage three, I was bulletproof. I like that. Okay. Spiritual. All that spiritual growth, what's it look like? Well, I think we have two models that we use a lot for spiritual growth. I mean, we think of it and we use what we're familiar with. One of them is spiritual growth is like a rocket. Higher, 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 faster, faster, faster. Direct line up. Boom. See? I don't think it's true. I don't think it works like that. Other model. Spiritual growth as the Dow Jones Industrial Index. Up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. That doesn't work for me either. But that's a model a lot of people use. The one that makes sense to me was kind of put together by a Jesuit, as a matter of fact, named Teilhard de Chardin. And what Chardin, he was an anthropologist and a poet and silenced by the Vatican, which indicates he had something to say. What he saw was spiritual growth, the growth of the person, and that's what we're talking about, the growth of the person as a spiral. And it goes around. And it goes around. And it goes up sometimes, and it goes down like this sometimes, but it keeps on going around, and you finally develop, sometimes real wide spiral, sometimes not so. This explains to me why it seems we keep coming up to the same stuff over and over and over again, because we keep visiting the place, but from a little different angle. You know? And then all of a sudden you touch it again, and you go away from it again, you might go way up, and then you touch it again. Spiritual growth, the growth of the person is like a spiral. And that's why it's very hard to measure. And why every so often you hit landmarks and you notice that your world is much bigger than it used to be. Because your spiral's gotten bigger. Some of us have real narrow spirals, some of us much bigger. But it kind of goes like that. I need a picture or I can't see what's happening. And that's the picture I use. Not the rocket, not the Dow Jones. The second step of recovery says, where are you? There you are. It says, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That's what it says. Now, I'd like to break that up just a little bit and talk about a few things. Number one, we talk about feelings so much in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and feelings are real crucial to our recovery because most of us are so shut down when we came in, just shut down. I mean, I sure was. But notice the step doesn't say, came to feel that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. It says we came to believe. The problem with feelings is that feelings come and go. This is true in relationships, it's true in jobs, it's true in families. I mean, there are sometimes I meet somebody and I figure, I want to spend forever with this person. And 5 days later, I want them arrested. Feelings change. Which one's a right feeling? Well, you don't have right feelings, you just have feelings. Some feelings are appropriate and some feelings are inappropriate, you know. But feelings aren't right or wrong. And I didn't know that for a long time. This says we came to believe. And I want to talk a little bit, therefore, about God on this because it's very, very wrapped up. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew a lot about God. I knew a lot about God in five languages. And it didn't help. It did not keep me sober. Knowledge doesn't always help. And insight doesn't always help. Our problem is not information. A lot of times our problem is not insight, it's action. And my problem with God is I knew a lot, and the God I believed in was wonderful. I mean, I didn't believe in an awful, vengeful, hateful God. I believed in a wonderful, creative God. That's the God I knew about, but I didn't believe that God would take care of me. I believed that God would take care of you, but not me. For some reason, I concluded that God would have nothing to do with me. How did that happen? Well, when I was around 9 or 10 or 11 or 12, somewhere in there, I discovered the world of masturbation. And it was wonderful, you know, at age 9 and 10 and 11. And it was my secret, you know. And what did I know about it? I know it felt wonderful, quick but wonderful. And I also knew I was the only adolescent male in the North American continent who was doing this. So it was my secret. Now, after I had developed the habit, which took, I think, 3 days, I later found out that this was an awful thing. This was so awful that doing this ruined God's whole day. And if you kept this up, you were damned. I mean, there was no if, ands, or but. This was morally as significant as dropping the bomb on Hiroshima, as far as, you know, my classroom was concerned. So we just got these very, very heavy messages, and at the age of 9 or 10 or 11 or 12, I mean, I was faced with some life and death stuff. And I didn't know you could talk about this with anybody, you know? Secrecy is so powerful. And I therefore knew that the obsession had to be removed, and I begged God daily for years to remove the obsession. And it didn't get removed. And I made a conclusion. And the conclusion I drew was this. God cannot touch my life. Everybody else. But not me. And so I pretty much had that already set out. So I always had this sense of doom, you know, somewhere, and that it was just awful. And I was just one of those awful people. And when I came into alcohol, and then, you know, I forgot about that decision. I mean, I don't know if I made that decision all at once or it was over a period of time, but that decision did get made. And when I got into sobriety, I mean, people were talking about the 12 steps of recovery, and you look at those things, and I mean, I just glazed over, right? But after a little clarity, I started noticing that people were doing a lot of God talk. And I so resented God talk. I didn't like being preached at. I didn't like being preached to. I didn't like being patronized. I still didn't like it. And in most churches, I found that's what was going on. But here, in the fellowship, I didn't find that. I found people were talking about their own experiences with God. And what I'm very grateful for is in this step, it says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And so what I decided to do was put God and the Pope and the dogmas of the church and all this stuff way back here on the back shelf. And I had better find for myself a power greater than myself. And that's what I went in search of. And I found such a power. It was a meeting in Berkeley we called Berkeley Wednesday Night. Not a big meeting. You know, it was big for us. We had, I guess, 40 people there on a pretty regular basis. In the city of Berkeley, we had one meeting a night. And now we have more than that, so you have to make decisions. But I just showed up wherever that meeting was. I'd go, you know. And in that Berkeley Wednesday night meeting, we had real old people and real young people. We had demonstrators, and we had people that beat up demonstrators. We had Catholics and ex-Catholics and atheists and ex-atheists and Marxists and ex-Marxists. And we had Hindus, and we had one Hare Krishna join us for a while. And she kind of stretched the group's tolerance. And there was one guy in there who told her that she would stay sober if she'd stay out of airports. That's what he told her. And we told him we didn't see that in the book. You know, it's not in the book. Doesn't mention that. So he, you know, had a little bigotry problem. We had married people and single people and people having relationships, you know, the like, gray area in between. What is your... See, I the word relationship is a funny word. I think I have a relationship with everybody I stumble across, you know, from people at the Lucky Market to, you know, folks I spend time with on a regular basis. And so it's kind of, but this is like a relationship with a capital R. You know, and I think it means they're sleeping together, but I'm not sure, you know. And I don't ask, I just fantasize. So, and we had straight people and gay people and people in between. We counted one night 14 different sexual persuasions in the room. You know? And that was a small meeting. It was just kind of, anyway, it was clear that everybody was present there, and what was stunning in the room was the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking, and when you walked in the room, you were accepted and loved. And people didn't ask questions. And therefore, this meeting became my higher power. And I emotionally felt loved there. Now, I went to a lot of other meetings throughout the week, and I secretaried a meeting on Friday night and stuff, but what emotionally I lived for was being fed in that room by the women and men that gathered there. And so for over a year, that meeting was my higher power. Then I kind of had to come to terms with God later on, and I really resented it. I didn't like letting go of old ideas. They were painful, but they were familiar. And I've always chosen that painful familiarity. Well, I was sober maybe a year, year and a half, 2 years, and by this time I'd moved down to Los Angeles where I was teaching. And I was, it was the end of one semester and the start of another semester. And I had a zillion papers to correct and term papers to read, which is, that's a slippery place, believe me. I was very angry and very hungry and very lonely and very tired. And I had, the next semester was starting in days, and I had all new classes to prepare, and I was just crazy as a coot. So I took all of my papers and I went outside to one of the parks in LA, and I thought, well, I would just, and it was pouring rain, of course. I just in the car with the radio going, a change of scenery to get stuff done, and all of a sudden, I had this tremendous desire to get loaded. No, not drink. Get loaded. And it scared me because the desire to drink, I knew pretty much how to handle that, but this one, it just came from out of left field, and it really was a monkey on the back. You know, like, monkeys, the reason we use that expression, I've got a monkey on it, very large arms and legs, they wrap themselves around you, and you can't get them off. You see? And all of a sudden you get this off, and the arm gets around, and you're, the desire to get loaded, to buy some non-habit forming marijuana and smoke my brains out. That's what I wanted to do. Well, I started arguing with it. No, you don't want this. Yes, you do. No, you don't. Yes, you do. No, you don't. Maybe just one. You know, no. And when I'm arguing with myself, I'm doomed. I cannot win that argument. And I got panicky, and I drove to a place in Hollywood called Joe's Place, which used to be behind the Presbyterian Church there, I guess. And walked into Joe's Place, and there was a 5 o'clock in the afternoon meeting, and this was like 9 people at the meeting, small meeting, and there was a character standing there named Aaron. Now, Aaron is from a religious tradition which he never practiced, and he was a street, different from mine, and he was a street junkie. And he was standing there, you know, arrogant. And I walked in, and I said, you know, talk about this at the meeting. So I went up to Aaron and I said, I want to get loaded. And he said, let's go to Mexico. And I judged him immediately. I said, this guy doesn't even know the rules. If I wanted to go to Mexico, I would have. I don't want to get loaded. That's why I'm here. And he doesn't understand that. So I instead of saying that, I very calmly said, because my mind is talking, but then I talk. I said, no, you don't understand. I do, but I don't, and I'm very confused, and I'm just being torn apart, and I'm very scared. And he said, well, you've got a choice. I said, what do you mean? And he said, you can either go get loaded, or you can go to your room, get on your knees, and ask God to remove the obsession. And I said to myself, who is he to be telling me to ask God? Thought, you know, that gong of truth, bong, rang, and I sat through the meeting completely obsessed, but I knew he was right. And now I was a year and a half, almost 2 years, probably a year and a half sober, almost 2 years. And I went back to my house and went up to my room, and I closed the door so no one would see. And I stood by the bed, and I had not asked God for anything yet. Because we've had this little, you know, understanding that it wouldn't work for years. And I was always afraid to test it. But this, I believe prayer is communication. I do not believe prayer is telling God sweet things. I think prayer is telling God the truth. And what I needed to do was tell God some real clear things. Let's clear the air before anything else goes on. And I said, first of all, God, I want you to know that I am very disappointed in you for going to this extreme to get me on my knees. And I let God know I was very angry at God, and I had thought better of God up to that moment. I thought we could have just gone along as neutrals. You know, God doing God's thing and me doing my thing, and we'll work it out some other time. But this God was just breaking in, and I really resented it. And I wanted that resentment very clear. See, my old idea of God, you know, the relationship between me and God, was this. It was like Washington, D.C. and Moscow. See, each one knows the other's there. But we'll ignore each other as long as we can until either one of us is in incredible trouble, and then we'll sign a peace treaty, which we'll keep for only as long as we absolutely have to. And then, boom, it's back to normal. You know, just leave me alone, be suspicious. Okay. Well, that was being shattered here, so I let God know, all right, the only reason I was doing this was because I had no other alternative. And if I had another alternative, I'd take it. Now, God, do you understand that? And then, once I was convinced God did understand that, I knelt down and asked God to remove the obsession. And it was removed. I mean, not next week. Not that then. And that terrified me. And all of a sudden, that monkey was literally taken off my back. And I became frightened, because it was clear to me that the program worked. And that scared me, because that was letting go of another old idea. And that idea was that I was someone who was doomed. And that was a familiar, sweet idea. But it suddenly occurred to me after a year and a half of going to an awful lot of meetings and talking to an awful lot of people and not having a drink or a joint or a pill in all that time, it suddenly occurred here that maybe I'm not doomed. Slow is real. You know? And it took me all of that time just to finally reach the point where just maybe I won't die drunk. Maybe. And it didn't feel good when I reached that point. It felt like I was off balance. It felt clumsy. Because all of a sudden I was changing things. And I don't think we change gracefully. If you want to be graceful, you're not going to get well. I think we change clumsily, and I think we fall down a lot, and I think that's all part of being real. When I was 12, my family went up to Squaw Valley. This was the last month of the Eisenhower presidency. I remember lots of things by who was president, because I always had someone to blame then. Anyway, last month of the Eisenhower presidency, so this was in December of 1960. And we went skiing. I was 12 years old, and the skiing was very primitive in those days. They had tow ropes, and you get pulled up the slope on these ropes. And I was 12 is not graceful to start with. You know, your body's weird. And 100,000 people had been up on this tow rope before me, so they had this thing, this rut in it of solid ice, very slippery, and I was afraid. And anyway, I got on this thing and I held on to the rope and got yanked up this slope. It was awful. And then how do you get off? How do you get off the rope? You're in this rut. So I fell, and I fell to my side, and there were millions of people behind me who kept screaming that my parents weren't married. And I remember clawing my way out of it, and several things, again, decisions we make at the age of 12. I felt humiliated, and I felt embarrassed, and I felt very clumsy. Now, I don't know about you, but those are the three worst feelings in my area. I think I could deal with the terminal disease a lot more calmly than I can feel with being embarrassed and humiliated. Death first. You know, and there's a postcard that says the impossible is easier to do than the embarrassing. And I think that's true. Anything but embarrassment, dear God. So when I was 12, I made a decision that I would never ski again. Who needs that kind of treatment? See? Well, I held on to that decision until maybe 20 years after that. I started feeling that decision soften a little bit, and I started talking about it about a year or two ago, and about 3 months ago, for the first time in 25 years, I went back on a pair of skis. But this time, with a lot of Al-Anon and a lot of AA program, I knew a couple of things, and also it was easier because the skis had been streamlined. I didn't feel like so clumsy. But first of all, it was clear to me, to learn, you have to fall down. Everybody falls down a lot. And what you do after you fall down is you get up. And you ask for help. And you ask people how to do it. And people will tell you. And you do it, and you fall down, and you go up and try it again, and you fall down, and you don't have to be graceful for months. Now that, I was black and blue. My thumbs are still sore. And I had a wonderful time because I gave myself permission to fall down a lot. In getting well, we need to give ourselves the exact same permission. We get well, some of us, we get into the program and we're convinced that if we're clean and sober or if we're serene, we're working on that path with 12 steps, this means I must be infallible. Not true. What it means instead is you can commit huge numbers of mistakes and talk about them. That's what recovery means. Not, I can't make a mistake. You can commit lots of them. And instead of being embarrassed to tears, propose it as a topic at your local discussion meeting. You know, that's different behavior. That's growth. That's spirituality. Well, what will people say? They'll probably say you have a drinking problem. You know, you have a couple of problems with relationships. Who doesn't? Came to believe. Now, after a while, you know, when I was sober for 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 months there, I was sitting at that Berkeley Wednesday night meeting, and it occurred to me that not only had I not had a drink for that period of time, or a joint, or a pill, but sometime back there, the compulsion to use was lifted. And I don't remember when it was lifted. I suddenly became aware of the fact it was gone. And I didn't do it. And that's what I came to believe, that a power greater than myself was involved in my life because I saw the results. And the results were that my desire, my compulsion to fix and use had been removed. That's when things started falling into place for me. And it took me another 6 months, a year to pray. You know, on the knees, that old kind of fact. But it started falling into place. And came to believe there are times today when I feel God's presence. There are times today when I feel God's absence. And there are lots of times when I don't feel much at all. But I believe God is present in all those times. I mean, belief is, I chose to believe. And I had to choose to believe, because I could also have chosen not to believe or chosen not to. I had to choose to believe that God was involved in my life. Well, what if I'm wrong? Then I'm wrong. But I chose to believe it. And it says in this step, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I believe. Does that mean I haven't figured out? No, because it doesn't say think or understand. It says believe. Believe, an important word. Well, what's sanity? Well, you get people talking in meetings. I'm not very sane. You see, sanity is one of those words that has a zillion meanings. And one of them is normal. Sane is normal. The first therapist I saw sober, I was sober about 3 months, and emotionally I was a disaster. I didn't come in pain. I came in numb, from head to toe, numb. Because I'd been taking depressants on a daily basis for years, you know, and when you take depressants on a daily basis for years, you get a little depressed. So I was just from head to toe shut down. The first psychiatrist I ever saw, who was a Southern Baptist Freudian from North Carolina. Can you imagine? You know, that guy needed to see a doctor. I mean, the topic at age 21 was, why am I so depressed? You know, well, here I am years later, you know, depressed still. Well, when the depressants are taken out of the body, it takes a little bit of time, but then you start waking up. And all of those things that were depressed, all those feelings and emotions and memories start coming up. And they do not come up polite, and they do not come up neat, and they do not come up graceful. And at 3 months, I was a disaster. Because all fears and anger, and they weren't even differentiated. I mean, I couldn't tell you what was fear and what was anger. All I knew is I was raw, real raw, and needed to use the F word a lot. Especially at meetings where there were lots of Irish Catholics. I just needed to do that. So, it was real awful, and so I went into therapy because I needed to have someone walk me through this, and by the way, the book says we can. It says here on page 133, this does not mean that we disregard human health measures. God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such people. That's in the book. Now, you wouldn't know that from some meetings, you know, where doctors are them, and they're the enemy, you know. Well, some of our experience with doctors and practitioners and shrinks has been we've gone to them for years and lied and didn't get well, and then blame them, you know. I find if you go to a doctor and tell the truth, amazing things happen. It's just, and some doctors are better than others, and some really understand addictions real well because they've got them themselves. They've worked with people for years who have them. So I went to see this character, and after I trusted him, I saw him twice a week for 9 months, and I was saying, I finally said, Leonard, do you think I'm normal? That's the big question. I mean, that is the ultimate. Am I normal? And he said to me with very wise Jewish eyes, he said, normal is 98.6. Period. And I said, excuse me? And he said, that's what normal means. I have lived my life by normal till that point, okay? Knowing either I was or how do I look normal or fit or talk, what a normal person saying. So then I thought, what am I trying to say? Well, what am I trying? Have I asked the wrong question again? And he said, I think you're trying to ask, are you healthy? And I said, okay, let's try that. Yeah. I mean, what does it mean to be a healthy person, and that's someone who is emotionally and psychologically sound. How do you know? How do you spot? Because I've been professionally ill for years. I mean, I would have sickness fantasies on a regular basis, knowing I had cancer, knowing I had leukemia, knowing I had bone disease. I mean, all the tumors, I could fantasize anything but alcoholism. And I never fantasized I was an alcoholic, but I mean, I was willing to go for anything else. Anyway, he said, when Sigmund Freud was doing his shtick, you know, in the early part of the century, Freud came up with a description of a healthy person. And Freud said that a healthy person was someone who could work and someone who could love. He said, since Freud's time, we've learned a lot of things. And I would now add a third word to that, said Leonard. I would say a healthy person is a person who can work, a person who can love, and a person who can play. If you know someone who is capable of doing those three things, you know a pretty healthy person. And I said, go on, you know. And I said, because I mean, I those were just words to me, and that's, I get an... I need to have simple words explained. And he said, Tom, what your alcoholism did was it destroyed your ability to work. You couldn't leave your room. I said, yes, I could. He said, I'm talking about 2 days in a row. And that was true. I mean, I found I could show up most places once, and I could show up some places twice. But three times in a row, I'd at least have to be late, you know. I just couldn't show up. So at work, all right, that was work. As far as loving goes, to love you need to trust. And he says, is there anybody in the... I said, sure, I trust a lot of people. He said, name one. And I said, George. He said, and where does George live? And I said, New York. And he said, have you seen George in the last 10 years? And I said, no, it's been a long time. He said, isn't it the further they are away, the more you can trust them? He said, is there anybody on the West Coast? You know.
No, I can't think of anyone right now. He said, oh, okay.
I was not trusting anyone. And at play, excuse me, see, my earliest memory as a child is that I did not want to be a child. I mean, I remember when my mother would dress me up like a little boy, I would just be mortified because I wanted to look like an adult at age 9. You know, give me a tie, forget this bow tie stuff, you know. Long pants now, you know, was kind of the way I went through my childhood. And my parents are nice folks. They really, I do not have a nightmare childhood story other than the fact that I was me, you know. As somewhat one guy told me, he said, the one thing he remembers about his childhood is him. That's true. I mean, there are lots I don't remember. One woman sharing in the Berkeley Fellowship, some people will put a tremendous amount of pain into a very small phrase, and she said, what was my childhood like? Well, I was real fat and we moved a lot. You know, there's a volume of pain there, you know. Next. Well, we were a nice... Both my folks worked, and they voted for Eisenhower, and, you know, I have two older brothers, and we lived in a house, and my father drinks a little, but he was the kind of alcoholic where he was always very busy, and then he'd come home and have a couple of drinks and pass out every night for years. So I felt emotionally abandoned, and no one left home. They were just gone. But the emotional, I mean, yeah, I was the youngest, and my parents were older, and they just didn't have time to do a lot of stuff like, you know, you do with kids normally. So I felt pretty abandoned. What's the point of all that? I know I needed to say it, but well, there was some very cleverly tied in theme. Let me see. Ah, play. We were taught that work is good. An idle mind is the devil's workshop. Busy hands are happy hands. Now, this was your basic family, but we were never encouraged to play. Playing was wasting time. And of all the things there are a lot of things that I guess some people would feel guilty about that I just don't feel any guilt about at all. Maybe it's suppressed, but I just think it's health. But the one thing I can still feel guilty about is taking time off. See? Because it's wasting time. And you should be busy. Oh, this feeds into the workaholism really nicely. And let, you know, being burned out is a wonderful way to live. That some of us have as our theme song. And I had to, I mean, how do you learn how to play, I asked Leonard. Is there a course you can take on this? See, one of my, if you could take a course, you know, then I could understand it. And he said, what you have to do is find out what happy people do. What do people on the planet do for play? I mean, watch them, yeah. Well, some people go bowling. Try it three times. The first time you'll hate it because you're clumsy. You know, but try it three times. Some people go scuba diving. Some people go backpacking. Some people go to museums. Some people go to plays. Television doesn't count, by the way. That's not play. That is Valium with a plug. It's really true. And I love it. Valium is lunch, as far as I'm concerned. But I find when I watch a lot of television, I emotionally shut down a lot. I stare. I don't talk. And I need, play means to be actively involved in doing something. Like, that is just fun.
Fun? You know, that sounds immoral.
Learning how to play. Some people play by cooking. For other people, that's work. Some people play by gambling. For other people, that's work. You know? Some people play by working in a garden. I play in a garden. Baking bread for me is playful. But you have to find out, you're your own laboratory. What's playful for you? How do you spend time?
Well, how much play should I do? A couple of times a year?
I would figure this. For me, I need, and this is the doctor told me, because I work real intensely with people all the time, that I need 2 full days off a week for me. 2 out of 7. Now, one of those days, I need to read and to study and to reflect. One of those days, I need to play all day, doing stuff. I mean, like going to Muir Woods or something, just getting out, and if the outdoors does it for you, go to the outdoors, just getting away. If on one of those 2 days you spend the day unconscious in bed, passed out, that doesn't count for play. That's survival. You know, and you aren't ready to play yet. And playing is a high spiritual art. You know, it's not something that just gets done easily. It's a lot of work. But learning how to play. But I can't do that. What I have managed to do is now I go through my calendar. I've gone through my calendar between now and December. And I have marked off 1 free day a week. Which means I don't even answer the phone that day. If I can stick with that, I hope I can. Otherwise, I just live by the phone. 1 free day a week, and every 10 to 15 days, I have 1 day of play. I can tell you right now on my calendar, what are my free days in November? Because if I don't do that, they fill up. Tom, I have to see you. When do you have a free day?
How about tomorrow? I was going to go to the beach, but I don't need to do that. You know, sure, drop on by and bring your suicidal spouse, you know. Love to spend the day with both of you, you know.
Now that is, I have to do that to get well. I need a calendar, and I've been sober for several years, and I'm just now taking this seriously, that I need to take that time off, and also that most people work 8 hours a day. 8 hours a day. You see, not 18. 8. And taking that seriously, and bringing in breakdown. I find that real hard to do. Alright, so that's as far as the play thing goes. As far as work, or as far as loving goes, I mentioned that before, love is not a hormone. And love is not sweaty palms. Love is not a feeling, for that matter. Love is action. Love is how you act to another human being or groups of other people. Love is a decision. And if you make a decision to be a lover, you make a decision that you will act in a certain way to people as often, as much as you can.
But I don't feel like cooking lunch.
You know? Well, maybe you should or shouldn't, but I mean, if you truly love, you might be able to do it. Even if you don't feel like it.
I don't feel like X or Y.
A lover can do it even when they're not. This is why parenthood for so many people forces them into be such tremendous lovers or such tremendous creeps. Because the demands are constant. Even when you don't feel like feeding the creep at 2 in the morning. You know? Come here. You know? Learning how to be a lover is a real serious business. And for most of us, it was so groinal for so many of us, and so hormonal. We go, I know how to do this real well, you know. Well, most of us, it's learning how to act in a certain way. Kind, patient, gentle. There are some women and men, and you see them on the program, and they are tremendous lovers. And you can learn a lot from them because of the kinds of things they do. They are usually the ones who don't, who are not in the limelight, too. I think that's true. Work. I found out I could show up to a job I didn't like. I could show up on time, I could put in a decent day's work, and I could leave on time. That was wonderful.
Because before, if I didn't feel like showing up, I wouldn't. Or if I wasn't perfect, I couldn't show up. Or I'd have to be excellent, or I'd leave early. I mean, I just couldn't. I was not trustworthy. But I found not only can I work, I can also change jobs. That's real intense. That's sometimes a real interesting topic at a meeting. How do you change jobs? What's that process? That's real stressful for most folks. Like some people, we come into recovery and we've got jobs. A lot of us still have jobs, you know? And you find out you've been doing it for a zillion years and now you're 3 years sober and you hate it. Because you used to be able to do this job loaded. And you can't do this job loaded anymore. And you've got to change not just jobs, but occupation. And that's terrifying for a lot of us. Because it's all I know how to do is X, you know? I'm a trained teacher. This is what most of my work has been involved in teaching. And I found, after 4 years of sobriety, the kids were wonderful, but the administration was driving me crazy. And I just hated putting up with all of their stuff. And I needed to do something else. And I went to a completely different kind of job for a while. I think people do change jobs. My father held the same job down for 40 years. And I was raised considering that to be normal. And this was also a sign of tremendous maturity. You know, that's not true. That's not true. Most healthy people change jobs. Tourism and prostitution. Not necessarily in that order. And it was a war zone. You had a tremendous number of shut-ins in the parish, elderly shut-ins, handicapped people, gypsies living, who, you know, from Europe, gypsies, Filipinos, Hispanics, runaways, kids from Kansas and Nebraska who still think they could make it in the movies, you know. And this is 1981, and they're showing up, you know, with their little backpack and blonde hair and 16 years of experience, you know. And there's only one kind of movie they're making in Hollywood with kids like that. And we figure from the time they landed on the streets to the time they ended up in a porno film, we had 48 hours to get them. Because what happens is all of a sudden they haven't eaten for 2 days. And a lot of things seem like a good idea, you know, to eat. And, you know, someone should take care of that. Well, fine, who? You know, who? No one's taking care of that. So anyway, that was going on a lot. What else did we find that was going on? Anyway, that's kind of the idea of the parish. Okay. So it was a war zone. There was also no park or green anywhere. It was all asphalt. And the phone would ring over 80 times a day. Now, on the other end of the phone was everything from things like, when is the 10:15 mass? We'd say 10:15, they'd say, thank you. It's true. That's a regular call to people who would say, I think there's a body in the next room. The response to that is, what do you mean, think? check, please, and call back. People who were dying, people who were crazy, one woman kept coming to the front door. The front door we had, I think it was over 70 people to the front door every day. People wanting a sandwich, to people who needed to talk, they were in legitimate crisis, to people who were just bonkers. When that man was governor of California, they tried to save money by closing down mental institutions. And if you were capable of walking and wiping yourself, you were let go. And a lot of things, they would have little residential centers where hopefully you'd show up for your Thorazine, and a lot of people didn't. And so we had all, and one of the centers was right in Hollywood. So we had all these people who were off their medication, who had no business being deinstitutionalized, and they would show up on the front door introducing themselves as Jesus or the Virgin Mary, you know. And it's a little hard to talk them down from something like that. So it was real, real crazy. Well, I was there about 4 weeks, and all of a sudden, you know, the doorbell rang and my headache started. I felt very stressed out. I felt panicky. I was afraid of walking across the parking lot. I mean, you were always being hit up for something. When you were on duty at the parish, and there were seven of us that worked there, you always had to have a Roman collar on.
Now, the reason I don't usually wear one is because when you have one on, no one sees your face. You see? You're a walking Rorschach test. All they see is the Roman collar, and they project a tremendous amount of love or a tremendous amount of hate. And I just got real tired of picking up on the fact that they were yelled at 30 years ago by someone I don't know, you know? So I just... But you would wear it around all the time there and get real, real shaky and crazy. And I was feeling overwhelmed. And incompetent. Let's add incompetent to the list because, I mean, objectively too, if you have the energy of seven people, you'd be incompetent there. I mean, this is like trying to make peace in Vietnam, you know? So, we had a meeting in Hollywood called the Hollywood Thursday Night Men's Stag. Serious AA meeting. And it was a problem-solving meeting, which I think, I don't know if women have problem-solving meetings. Men do because we think we can solve problems, you know, a little arrogance. There, we're used to it. We'll solve your problems. The format of the meeting was you would read from chapter 5 and then you would wait for the first person with a problem, and he would throw it out. And if you had a similar experience sober, you talked and got through it sober. You talked about it. So you might have half a dozen problems on the floor at the same time. When the moon got full, that meeting got fuller. It was one of those things. No one went there because they were having a good week either. This is not your glad to be alive and just thought I'd drop by. This is a... This was your crisis meeting. And also, this was one of those meetings where there was never any small talk. I mean, people didn't get to sit around and just, and you know, chat beforehand. People got in there, sat down, and were silent, waiting. You know, serious. So we read from chapter 5 one night and waited for the first guy with a problem to break. You know, go ahead and tell us. We waited 27 minutes. Try that one. Like we have that, does anyone have a topic and you wait for 10 seconds and you can't stand the silence? Well, let's talk about gratitude. Go ahead. 27 minutes of silence because we were all men and we were all fine, thanks. A lot of ego was on the line. And then finally the first guy broke, you know, and he just wanted to, oh, God.
You're all so relieved.
So I went to that meeting with my problem. You know, and I sat down there, and they read from chapter 5, and people were talking. And I said, well, here's my problem. I said, I've got a new job, and I just feel overwhelmed by it. I feel dumb, and I feel incompetent, and there's, and I, you know, I general outlines, because they didn't know what I was doing for a living, but it was just kind of general outlines on this, and that I just felt so incompetent, and what can I do? So there was a guy there named Chuck who was about 7 feet tall and weighed a pound. And he said, can I ask you a question? And I said, sure. He said, have you done this kind of work before? And I said, no, not really. I haven't. And he said, well, then you probably are incompetent. He said, what you get to do once you admit you're incompetent is learn how to do the job. And I never knew that. And I always thought you had to be perfect before you walked in the door. You had to know the material before you took the class. You had to know who done it before you started the book. It never occurred to me that I could be incompetent, inadequate, or in need of learning basic stuff. And I'm very grateful to that meeting because I found out once I allowed myself the right to be incompetent, I gave myself permission to learn. And I need to remind myself, every time I start a new job, I'm incompetent. Just after teaching, I went into a job with a group called the Jesuit Volunteers, which is like a domestic peace corps. And I was the director of the project, and we had like 70 volunteers in the Southwest. And we work with marginal people, elderly, handicapped, inner-city kids, and it's all kinds of people right out there on the cutting edge, you know, the people we don't think are nice people. And my job was being an administrator and being a fundraiser. Now, I had never done either before. And I found I could do both. Last year, 2 years ago now, my last year in the job, I had to raise $40,000 so we could pay bills. And I did. But I found in that 3 years I was director of the Jesuit Volunteers, I learned a lot of things I never wanted to know. And I was stretched a lot. And it was a real hard job. And on a regular basis, I was incompetent. And it was real painful. And I was able to show up a lot of the time. Not all the time, but I was able to show up a lot of the time. But I really had to take care of myself in that job because it was so stressful. And it was so new. And I'm very glad I did the job, and it was a tremendous relief to be let out of it and do something else. But a lot, you know, work isn't always a million laughs. Sometimes I needed a program tremendously, and what I needed, I worked with the staff, and I, for a while, we lived in West Oakland, which is a rough neighborhood, by the way. And the whole staff lived together, and there were, I think, 3 men and 2 women on the staff, and I was the director. And I fired one of the women. She refused to go, but I did fire her, even though I fired her. And we were living together. So I fired her and had breakfast with her the next day. Awful experience. And so I found there were all of these, the staff, and I'm a nice man, the staff was divided, there was arguing going back and forth, people were questioning my basic, not just competence, but motives, you know? There was all kinds of ugly stuff that went on for a year, and it was real crisis, and I found out that for a period of time, I was in a real survival mode. Not glad to be alive, survival mode. And it meant that I went to a lot of AA and a lot of Al-Anon. I had to use a very strong Al-Anon program at that time because there were so many angry, manipulative people, and I was one of them. And I had to find out how to let go. I had to find out how to turn it over. I had to find out how to not hold resentment. And that was real painful. And the Al-Anon program helped me tremendously there. AA helped me a lot with my sobriety and me, but Al-Anon helped me in dealing with anybody else. And that's one of the reasons I go to it. One of the things I found, and people do give practical hints, as I was working with these people, I mean, after I fired this woman, walked into my staff, and no one would talk to me for 6 months, not for 3 months. No one would say hello. Little chilly. So, I'm a very nice man. So I would go and I would just feel wounded. I mean, and my body language showed. I mean, I was all hunched over like that. I decided what I had to do was, even though they will not say hello to me, I will say hello to them. So, and you know, chilly, chilly stuff. So I would walk up to each one and touch them on the arm in a nice, non-threatening place, you know, and I would say, good morning, hello. You know, and then I would do with each person there, and that helped me make contact with them. And then I was able to do my job. Then I'd go to a meeting and come back and do more. And then, but it was just awful. And I found during those kinds of times, I really used these steps and these principles to survive. And that was 5 years sober. Sometimes I think we think that once we've gotten a certain amount of time, life is easy. You know, the slogan is "Keep coming back; it gets better." Well, I don't think that's true. Sometimes it gets awful, awful, and part of the reason is, I mean, I think what's true is this: keep coming back; it gets different. When I was drinking, it never got different. It was always the same. You know, it made no difference if it was July or December or, you know, Tuesday or Christmas. It was the same because I was the same. I was depressed and self-centered. I find out in the program, things get different. One of the women in the East Bay says, when you get sober, you feel better. You feel everything better. And that's true. For a lot of us, it's the first time we deal with disappointment and hurt and failure without anesthetic. And the pain is extraordinary. When I was locked up for drunk there in the hospital, the ward next to us was the burn unit in the hospital. And the burn unit is, burns are the most, well, I think, the most severe damage you can do to the body is a severe burn. And these were folks, you know, old folks, little kids, and they would have burns on 60 to 90% of their body, third degree. And I think it's the toughest ward in the hospital. And when you first are severely burned, you don't feel anything. Did you know that? You don't feel anything. Because all the nerves are burned off too. And so you're just numb. You leak a lot, you know, because your skin's... But you don't feel anything until you start getting well. And then the nerves regrow. And the first sign that you're getting well is you go into agony. And people on the staff go around saying, this pain means you're getting well. This pain means you're getting well. You can walk through this. This pain means you're getting well. I need to hear that on a regular basis because I didn't think it meant I was getting well. I thought I was losing my mind with it. I thought I was doing something wrong with it. But it's not. Pain comes and goes. Pain is one of those parts of being alive. And frequently when something new is tried, it is painful and awful. I know at that 3 months' time when all of my emotions went raw, I was enraged for the next 18 months, with an occasional day off, you know, but basically enraged. And I had to let people give me a lot of space and tell me it was perfectly okay to just sit there and scream, you know. I mean, scream as long as you need to and swear as long as you need to. I went to one meeting, it was only gentlemen are here. I knew I couldn't go back. You know? I mean, who needs them? I need to go to a place where you don't have to be a gentleman, you know? Where you can instead tell the truth on occasion. And I didn't do it polite and I didn't do it neat. But I did it. And I found that the healing did take place over time. Through the help of a lot of meetings. Through the help of some real good therapists and God the Source who used all those people to touch me. And I still, good and bad days, you know, how there are good and bad days. There are some days it's wonderful being alive and there are some days it's kind of slow. That's real. Let me end by saying, in this business of being restored to sanity, what occurred to me about... I talked earlier this morning about God. What can we know about God? I think you learn a lot about God by looking at what God does. You learn a lot about a musician by listening to the music. You don't learn everything. You don't know if the musician was white or black or fat or thin or Hungarian or Romanian. But from the music, you can hear some stuff. Like if you ever listen to Rachmaninoff late at night, you know he's nuts. Because, I mean, he's... bonkers stuff. But kind of thrilling, you know. I'm always attracted to bonkers. No, you can listen to Tchaikovsky and hear the passion and anguish and you know stuff. Looking at a painting, you know a lot about the painter. You might say, this guy's pretty dull. You know? This guy's very creative. This guy does... Looking at creation, you learn a lot about the creator. And looking at you, what do I know about God? I know God is a healer. Because I see the healing process that has not just happened in me, which I can clearly point to when I bother to remember, but I can see the healing process in you. You see the newcomers coming in with dead eyes. And in 3 months their eyes are alive. And then they ask, do you think there's a resurrection? You bet there is. It happens all the time. As we see women and men come back from the dead, not from their own power, but from a power greater than themselves. So that's why this is the power that restores us to sanity, like restores us to work, to love, and to play. The Latin word for health is sanus, from which we get sanity, sanitize, sanitation. To be sane is to be emotionally and psychologically healthy. And that means you can work and love and play. You know, at least you're capable of that. Some days I work more than play, and some days I play more than love, and those things fluctuate all the time. But the capability is there now where it wasn't before. I think it's time for lunch. And then we've got free time. I'm going to start seeing folks about 2 o'clock. Rich, I'll meet Rich here. If you haven't taken a nap yet in your sobriety, napping is an important part of the program. And then we'll meet, I think it's at 4:30, I guess, in here for the Mass, for those who'd like to attend. Like I said, you're most welcome to come and take part in that. Why don't we end with the Lord's Prayer?